This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
I'm very disappointed. South Africa is collapsing. Really is collapsing through about water, load shedding, electricity, those stuff, the shortage of food, you know, so many things, the crime.
That's Isaac Rabotapi, a South African security guard marking Nelson Mandela Day with concerns about the country's problems. Also, Chad's military leader pardons 110 more people jailed following anti-government protests. And a planned concert at the Giza Pyramids by U.S. rapper Travis Scott has been banned. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The fighting continues in Sudan unabated today. More than 3 million people have been displaced since April 15th when the conflict began. Shahad Hamu, the gender advisor in Sudan for Mercy Corps, is here with us in the studio. Shahad, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You were forced to evacuate when fighting first erupted in Sudan in April between the Sudan Army and the Rapid Support Forces. We've heard many terrifying reports of the brutal conflict there and its impact on civilians, especially in the capital, Khartoum, Darfur, and elsewhere. Can you tell us what your experience was like when you were trying to get out?
Yep. So about a week into the fighting, it was quite unbearable in our neighborhood. There was an increase in rockets and grenades, so it just wasn't safe to stay home any longer. So we made a journey which took about an hour to Umm Durman, which is another large city in Sudan.
And that's not far from the capital, Khartoum, right?
No, usually on a non-conflict day, it would take about 20, 30 minutes. On that day, it took about an hour. There were several military checkpoints. We had to go through specific safe routes. So the coordination just took a lot longer. There were several military tanks, military trucks, military personnel all over the streets. We could hear fighting, but luckily we didn't come across anything severely life-threatening.
You left about a week or so after it started?
Yeah, I'd say I think it was about 7 days into the conflict. And then from Umm Durman, we left the next day by road to Egypt, which took about 12 hours to reach the Aswan border. And then from then, we traveled to Cairo.
So you say that women have been disproportionately affected by this conflict. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yep. So all over the country, we're seeing extremely increased rates of sexual and gender-based violence. We have reports of about a million people needing some assistance for gender-based violence experiences. And this takes the total to about 4 million. It's been worse in some regions than others, but we have many reports from Khartoum and Darfur specifically. And, you know, this doesn't just, it's not just about the actual gender-based violence, but also the repercussions after for psychosocial health.
Sure.
So it's been very grave and it continues to worsen.
Yeah, we've heard stories about the rapes and even gang rapes and people just trying to get out for a few minutes to fetch water or firewood. I can't imagine.
Exactly.
Aside from being a gender advisor for Mercy Corps, you are also the program lead for Mercy Corps' Peacewise project. What is that all about?
So Peacewise is a program that was started in 2020, so just after the transitional government came into play. And the core purpose of that program is to engage local and grassroots women in political discourse, in decision-making, and other civic processes. What we did and do in that program is work with women across South Darfur and South Kordofan and really get their leadership capacities up to play to be able to engage with these different policymakers on a state, on a local state and national level. So, as you know, there's been various different political processes going on in Sudan, various negotiations, and our core goal was to support these women in strengthening their capacities to be able to really represent their communities and engage in these different processes.
Women were pivotal in the whole revolution, weren't they?
Exactly, and women continue to be pivotal and have been pivotal in just the culture in Sudan over time. women are very strong in Sudan and they always take on leadership roles and perhaps don't get the credit they deserve.
During peacetime, how were you advising women to become a force in Sudanese politics?
So with Peacewise, we have taken various women from different backgrounds through different training programs. And these programs don't just include training on conflict resolution, negotiation and peace building, but also how to be a leader, how to put forward your ideas to different policymakers, how to collate feedback from your community and be able to translate that to different audiences, how to be able to identify different needs from different people in your community, how to create buy-in from different stakeholders, including men and boys in communities, to ensure that what you're trying to do actually gets taken as far as it can for different buy-in.
What about women's rights now in Sudan? I mean, obviously, there's too much bloodshed going on at the very moment, but where does it stand? I mean, do you really have hope that women will be, you know, among the leaders when however this gets resolved?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the conflict has put a real great risk to any work that has been done in the past decades in Sudan, and particularly in the transitional period. There is a huge risk. But I think it's our role as a organization, and it's our specific role with the Peacewise program to continue pushing different policymakers and people engaged in these negotiations to continue including women, and being able to connect them to these women that we work with, and continue feeding in their voices. So while there is a huge risk, there's also still a real strong opportunity to ensure that we do things in the right way going forward.
That is Shahad Hamu. She is the general gender advisor in Sudan for Mercy Corps. She's here with us in the studio, and she's also the lead for the Mercy Corps project called Peacewise. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Every year on Nelson Mandela's birthday, which is July 18th, the South African government calls on citizens to honor the global icon's legacy by doing good deeds. But almost 10 years after the anti-apartheid legend's death, with South Africa suffering record levels of unemployment, widespread blackouts and corruption scandals, many say the current government is itself failing to honor Mandela. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison in his fight against racist white minority rule, is a hero to many in South Africa and across the world. After he became the country's first democratically elected president in 1994, there was a great sense of hope for South Africa under his leadership of the African National Congress Party, or ANC. But his successors, all from the ANC, have had mixed reviews, with one, former President Jacob Zuma, facing trial on multiple counts of corruption. Many critics say the once storied Liberation Party has become bloated, corrupt, and inept, though others argue the brutal legacy of the apartheid system has made it hard to turn the country around. What ordinary South Africans who spoke to VOA on the streets of Johannesburg did agree on this Mandela Day, however, was that the man many refer to as Tata, or Father, is sorely missed. Isaac Rabutapi, a security guard, remembered the day in 1990 when he was a young child and Mandela was released from prison.
We were so happy in Soweto. Even children, we couldn't sleep even in that day because we were so happy, like he was out of jail. We do remember so many things about him. Actually, we miss him.
Rabutapi says the country's current leaders haven't lived up to Mandela's huge legacy.
I'm very disappointed. I think Tata would be very crying to see, like, South Africa is collapsing. Really is collapsing through about water, load shedding, electricity, those stuff, the shortage of food, you know, so many things, they cry.
Agnes Mashole, who owns a beauty salon, also remembers the celebrations when Mandela and the ANC won the first election after apartheid. But like Rabutapi, she laments the widespread power failures known here as load shedding, which have badly affected Africa's most developed economy, and expresses disappointment with the current government.
They failed. They, like, really failed. I wish we could just wake up Mandela and fix everything. The economy is going down. With this load shedding, it's worse.
Asanda Nakosheng, an independent political analyst, told VOA South Africa was a complex country because of its history.
Yes, corruption does leave a stain in the ANC, and it is a difficult issue to deal with, and it is disappointing for South Africans considering the legacy of Mandela. But there is a lot that the ANC has done for South Africa and continues to do for South Africa, particularly Black South Africans.
To mark Mandela Day, President Cyril Ramaphosa inaugurated two new statues of the revered statesman and made a speech about following in his footsteps. However, if the ANC doesn't fix some of the problems plaguing the country, it may no longer be able to retain power simply by trading on Mandela's legacy. South Africa holds elections next year, and recent polls show the ANC might lose its parliamentary majority for the first time since coming to power. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Chadian leader General Mahamat Idris Deby Itno has pardoned 110 more people sentenced to prison terms following deadly protests against the government last October, according to a decree the French news agency AFP has seen. Demonstrations against the extension of Deby's transitional rule broke out in the capital, N'Djamena, and several other towns. More than 600 young men, including at least 80 minors, were arrested in N'Djamena on October 20th and in the following days, and then sent to a prison in the desert town of Korotoro. AFP says a total of 436 people convicted of taking part in those protests have been pardoned in less than 4 months. Chad consistently ranks among the bottom five countries in the UN's Human Development Index with poor life expectancy, education, and living standards. In this report from N'Djamena, Chad, Henry Wilkins speaks to residents who struggle to imagine a decent future for their families and to experts about what can be done to kickstart development.
In Chad's capital, N'Djamena, Ola Suleiman sits by the side of the road breaking rocks to sell for use in construction. She says life for her and her family is grueling, but she sees no other way to make a living. She says it's very hard to live here with no money, adding that her children can't go to school to become well-educated, although she has learned to accept the situation because she doesn't have any other choice. Chad, along with its neighbours Niger and Central African Republic, consistently finds itself at the bottom of the United Nations Human Development Index. The HDI was created in 1990 as a measure of a country's prosperity. It takes into account factors such as life expectancy, education and per capita income. Suleiman is not alone. 6.5 million Chadians live below the poverty line, a number that rose by 38% between 2011 and 2019, according to the World Bank. Omar Bourid, a mother of four, lost her home to floods that devastated parts of Chad a year ago and now lives on a public soccer pitch in N'Djamena. She says that it's really difficult to find a good job and that everyone is suffering. Everyone here is having a hard time. While for decades, non-profits and development banks have been pouring money into projects to stimulate growth in countries like Chad, many in Central Africa question why there appears to be little progress. One economist says rising population is a major factor. Chad has a birth rate of 6.5 children per woman, compared to less than 2.0 in many developed countries. Kingsley Magalu is a Nigerian economist.
Uncontrolled population growth is a recipe for entrenching poverty cycles, and in fact creating more conflict in the future, because the competition for resources becomes stronger and more acute the more people you have.
In Central Africa, conflicts over resources are becoming more common, many experts say, which in turn leads to more development problems. Hans Freitas is the Niger country manager for the World Bank.
A lot of those resources, the little resources they have, they need to invest in their army and in their security forces. So there's a question of what comes first, right? So does the government need to invest more in education and then less in its own security?
He added that the development efforts have been successful in African countries, such as Ivory Coast, as has localized development in Niger's capital, Niamey. But the slow pace of development in Chad means people like Suleiman suffer. She says she feels she has no chance at prosperity. She says she feels sick, especially at night, and that she and the others who work breaking rocks are exhausted. The experts VOA spoke to agree that harnessing the political will and mobilising entire countries to break these cycles is essential to solving development woes. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Jemena, Chad.
I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. The Egyptian Musicians Syndicate announced today it would not allow a planned concert at the Giza Pyramids by U.S. rapper Travis Scott in a rare move, citing offense to traditions. The French news agency AFP says the union rarely opposes such events, but in recent years has spearheaded a fight against musical genres deemed improper in Egypt, with rap a frequent target. The union says that after examining a social media content and the artist's positions, the syndicate found images and documented information on the strange rituals he practices, which go against our traditions. It did not specify which rituals the union attributes to the hip-hop heavyweight, who is now on a world tour. AFP says Egypt has increasingly opposed what it views as a rewriting of its history, finding fault with African-American movements that claim cultural affiliation to the ancient pharaohs. Russia on Monday ended the Black Sea Grain Initiative, as it's called, which guaranteed the free flow of Ukrainian grain to the rest of the world. Poor nations, already struggling with food insecurity, are expected to be affected the worst. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias explains.
Ships transporting Ukrainian grains to food insecure countries will no longer be guaranteed a safe passage in the Black Sea. Russia halted the so-called Black Sea Grain Initiative after complaining about the effects of Western restrictions on Russian food and fertilizer products. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov.
As soon as the stipulated part of the Black Sea Agreement related to Russia is fulfilled, Russia will immediately return to the implementation of the deal.
Turkey and the United Nations brokered the deal last summer to ease the repercussions of Russia's war against Ukraine, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
These initiatives has ensured the safe passage of over 32 million metric tons of food commodities from Ukrainian ports. Hundreds of millions of people face hunger and consumers are confronting a global cost of living crisis, and they will pay the price.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also decried Russia's decision, as he noted that food prices have already jumped.
We'll look at to see what else can be done to find other ways to get Ukrainian food products on the world market, including, again, moving as Ukraine's already been doing, moving things out through through rail and by road. But in terms of the volumes necessary, it's really hard to replace what's now being lost as a result of Russia weaponizing food.
African countries already struggling with the effects of climate change will be particularly hurt by Russia's decision, said Kate Phillips Barrasso with a humanitarian organization, Mercy Corps.
It's not just grain that's not getting out of Ukraine, but it's also fertilizers, which are really essential and required for producing food on a mass scale.
As the threat of hunger rises, another group is calling on the United States to ramp up its support for ongoing humanitarian efforts. Bob Kitchen is with the International Rescue Committee.
The U.S. should get their checkbook out and make sure that they're saving lives through donating funds to these countries who need it the most.
Ukrainian officials told VOA that their exports will be badly affected by the Kremlin's decision, but that they will try to find other methods to distribute their products. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story that resonated with you. Share a favorite memory about VOA Africa, and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. That number again is +1 202 258 3076. And thanks for 60 years of support. Tunisia has overtaken Libya as the top embarkation point for African migrants heading to Europe, starting in Italy. Tunisia's leaders have recently signed a deal with the EU to work together to reduce migrant flows. But as Dale Gavlak reports, challenges still persist.
Matt Herbert is a senior analyst with the Geneva-based Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. He tells VOA there are several factors explaining why Tunisia is overtaking Libya as the main embarkation point to Italy. One is the rapid increase in magnitude in departures from Tunisia that greatly surpasses those from Libya, especially this year. Italian Interior Ministry figures show more than 15,500 people arrived on Italian shores from Tunisia from January until the end of March, in over 180 landings per day. Italian officials say it's a 920% increase compared to the 1,525 arrivals in the same period last year. As of last week, the Italian Interior Ministry recorded more than 75,000 migrants that had arrived by boat on Italian shores since the beginning of the year, compared to about 31,900 in the same period last year. Herbert says Tunisia's deeply troubled economy in the aftermath of the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, terror attacks affecting the Mediterranean country's prime income earner, tourism, and then COVID-19 are the main factors. He says worsening economic and political situations are hitting Tunisia's people, and adding to that, African migrants are coming to the country for work.
The continuing economic challenges have had a real impact on their bottom line. The money that they're able to earn has been drastically reduced, facing economic difficulties in staying in country, and so some are leveraging the money that they already have to leave. The dynamic of departures being very closely linked to rising xenophobia.
Herbert adds that a multi-year rise in irregular migration from Tunisia has seen a growth in human smuggling networks along the Tunisian coastline, providing more escape routes. At its nearest point, Tunisia lies approximately 130 kilometers from the Italian island of Lampedusa. On Sunday, the European Union committed financial assistance to Tunisia in exchange for its added efforts to combat human trafficking and strengthen its border controls. The EU has already offered Tunisia more than $1 billion in long-term aid. Tunisian analyst Tazneen Abderrahim, a migrant policy analyst with the Washington-based Middle East Institute, debunked the perception that North African countries are willing to do anything in exchange for money, saying there are mitigating factors.
Now there are concerns that Italy may be seeking to deport sub-Saharan nationals to Tunisia. The repatriations of Tunisian nationals is already happening, and Tunisia has very advanced cooperation with Italy in that sense. But the readmission of third country nationals is definitely something that Tunisians, both the government and the population, reject. There are very little incentives on the Tunisian side to engage in such form of cooperation.
Racial tensions and anti-migrant sentiment are growing in Tunisia following the death of a Tunisian man on July 3 in a fight between locals and migrants. Observers say Tunisia does not have a legal framework to welcome migrants.
The International Monetary Fund's Executive Board has approved a $271 million extended credit facility for Burundi, with an immediate disbursement of more than $62 million. Reuters News Service notes that the East African country's economy is just starting to recover from years of conflict and political upheaval under former leader Pierre Nkurunziza. Which left key sectors blighted. The IMF said the local facility will help address Burundi's balance of payments needs, rebuild external buffers, and support the government's reform agenda. An IMF statement said money is expected to catalyze donor funding, which it said is essential to cater to Burundi's large financing needs and support its exit from fragility. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, please visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabro, and our engineer, Deneb Abdelrahman, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.